started off. I came up here in the mid '60s,
and
we lived at. I was born down in Perth.
Mm-hmm.
I came up in the mid '60s, and we landed at Roebourne, which in those days was, you know, I thought it was really the arsehole end of the earth for sure. And I think if anybody had, I'd had a gun, I would have hijacked the plane to go back to Perth. But that was just a first impression. I'd spent 5 hours on the plane with two little toddlers and landed at this dreadful, dreadful place in the middle of the desert. And, you know, I wasn't very impressed. And
what
if anybody had told me, he works with the medical department, and so we came up with his job. He transferred to the hospitals up here. He does the engineering side of things. And if anybody had told me that I'd still be here nearly 20 years later and be the member for the area, I would have died laughing, you know. So that was sort of my background.
And you didn't have any cabinet, I think.
We had ceiling fans in those days, but you made your own coolness one way or other, mm-hmm. whether it was out on the front lawn hosing yourself down or whatever.
So,
living in Roebourne, which is the town adjacent to Wickham, I did see that project built because it didn't come on stream until, I think, late 1960s, the construction took place there. And that, I also saw what happened to Roebourne as a result of that construction era when all these single men poured into the place and had a very adverse social effect, particularly on the Aboriginal people of Roebourne. So, from there, I sort of seeing the project develop, eventually I moved into Wickham and now live in the town. And so when that...
You live in Wickham still?
Yeah, and when that dispute happened, of course, I was right in the thick of it. I was surrounded by friends who were involved, unionists that I'd known for many years. I actually worked for Robe River when it was still Cliffs Robe River. I started there in about 1976... and worked in the personnel area for 3 years and then went down into the maintenance area and worked for the maintenance superintendent. And that was during the time when they were just in the throes of folding up the pellet plant, which was the processing of iron ore. They used to make these little iron pellets, and that became... the correct word is it was no longer viable. The Japanese mm-hmm. weren't interested in that type of iron, and the cost of oil fuel was blowing out at the time, and so it just wasn't, you know, viable for that to keep going. And so that plant closed down, and because I was the only old duck out there that could take shorthand, and they wanted the negotiations to be taken down verbatim, I was very much involved in that side. And so I suppose for me that was an education about the closed shop situation at Cliffs, how the unions negotiated, and at that particular time they were fighting for every last job, you know.
Oh, this was when the redundancy
deal was worked out,
mm-hmm.
and I must say, I mean, the union guys were magnificent. They were really, they had that skill, that negotiating skill, that they were able to negotiate an extremely good deal to keep every last job they possibly could. And
when you say the union guys, are these the conveners and these people, or are you talking about the union sort of organisers? No,
they were the on-site union.
On the on-site, yeah. I believe that the on-site union there was very strong.
Yes. Now, that strength really dates back to I wrote the date down here somewhere. You had it in here. 1974, you've written here, union conveners who take responsibility for the everyday on-the-job worker-boss
yeah.
relations are paid by the management. In 1974, the metal trades convener, Norm Marlborough, who is now the member for Coburn, made a very strong bid to have an office established and to become a full-time convener. I think if it hadn't been for his strong character and personality, that would never have happened. So he was the first. And actually, I've just spoken to him this morning to get that date.
Oh,
and are you going down to Perth, Wendy?
Yes,
because
I am.
I'd strongly recommend that you have a... Yeah, because he goes back to that era. He was the first person who established that union strength there on the Robe River site. And he would be able to even probably remember when a lot of the different conditions and that were negotiated. Within a few months, he had assisted the AWU convener, who was then David Dawkins, to establish the same setup, and the ETU sort of followed on some months later. So that was when
AMWU.
So that was how the office and the full-time convener positions came about. And
was there much resistance from the management?
I think there was a certain amount of resistance, but they just kept talking, and I don't know whether they took any industrial action. You'd have to check with Norm about that.
Yeah, the management there seems to have been prepared to give a great deal for production to keep things rolling along. They seem to have given a lot more concessions than the other men.
From my recollection, they didn't give in easily, always. No. When I worked there, my impression of the company was that, from my point of view, I was working in a secretarial personnel assistant type position, and I thought that they were fairly good working conditions. The wages were reasonable, but not, over generous. Yeah, and you could work several hours overtime each day, which, bumped your wages up, so that was good. For people who didn't live in company accommodation, there was a living out allowance, so... generally, that was a good job to have. And they also, of course, provided on-site meals. You could go in at lunchtime and have a smorgasbord type salad or whatever you wanted, in the mess room.
I suppose all this seems enormously generous. I mean, meals, biscuits for morning tea, all these things, to people who work in the East where none of those things, it still wouldn't have added up. I mean, all these perks, like, flying to Perth and that sort of thing, that sound to us like absolutely incredible, it wouldn't have still added up to a life of luxury it just helped you cope with the environment around.
And, of course, in the early days, there were no local shops and things. I mean, you couldn't go down the road and buy a sandwich for lunch, So, naturally, the company put those things in. As far as I know, right from day one.
To get you up here and keep you here.
Well, this is it, so that they could, develop a good workforce. And when I went on the scene, they'd been operating, I suppose, for 4 or 5 years. And, I mean, it was just a condition of employment that there was a meal available there. And I think you paid $3 a week or something out of your... was taken out of your salary each fortnight to as your contribution. Mm. It didn't cover the cost of meals, of course, but it was something.
This sort of whole idea that Rhodes was a soft option, that was tough, you only had to ask and you got, was not really your experience.
No, I always considered them the toughest company I'd ever worked for, and that was miles before Pico arrived on the scene. And it was in fact at Cliffs Road River that I ran into my first experience of discrimination. After I'd been working for the personnel superintendent for a couple of years, they had a bit of a problem with staff, and gradually I sort of took over all these duties, which were really in the area of a personnel officer. And there was a position coming up at one stage which he recommended to Perth that I be appointed. I was his secretary, and he was really bumping me up. It would have meant a substantial increase in salary and a different job, which I would have liked to have done, working with people, which is my thing. Anyway, the objections from the hierarchy in Perth were that, I heard, later, were that, number one, I was a woman, and, this is a tough country, you don't put a woman in that sort of position. And the other thing was my political affiliation, which they didn't think was acceptable to senior management.
Because you'll be the Labor Party
now. Yes, I was secretary of the local branch. Wickham branch. And so, on that basis, they decided not to appoint me to this position. I subsequently left the personnel department and went down to work in the maintenance area for the maintenance superintendent, which was quite good. I think that brought me closer to the workforce, really. Our office was located above the main workshop, and
personnel was a just suspect to workers, isn't it? They sort of see it as people who are trying to get the workers to do what the bosses want them to.
Yeah, well, in those days they had different schemes and things operating, such as the accident and sickness policy that they had in place, and I was already administering those sort of things, and I didn't mind the type of work that I was doing. It was rather good, but in the areas of you know, wage disputes and things like that, I suppose. So, that particular section wasn't the greatest. I always considered them, although the working conditions when I landed in the job were reasonably good, I always considered that they were, you know, a tough lot of managers. When I first arrived there, there was a chap, Fred Madden, who was the general manager of operations, and you know, it took a lot to beat Fred at negotiating. You know, he was a tough hombre. He's still with the company, actually. He's working down in Perth now.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting, because sort of everybody sort of says, oh, well, you know, they were a real, the workers they never had to really fight, they were a really soft option.
Oh, no, that's not the case at all. There were some real battles of the wits, and it was on all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think because the early managers were so tough, that led to the development of a tough union group,
yes,
a closed shop, you know, a really, really different situation probably to what you'd find anywhere else in the state.
Yeah, I've never heard of anything like that. I didn't know what a convener was. We over there, we had shop stewards, but in the Middle East, I never heard of a convener.
Well, they still had shop stewards throughout the whole operation, because it's a pretty big project out there. At the time I worked there, there was about 800 or 900 people all told. And so they had shop stewards in each section, and the convener worked out of an office and was available there, and I think even the shop stewards in those days were permitted to contact the convener if they had a problem.
Yeah, this is interesting. It seemed to me, you see, that there was sort of, it was all laid down rules and very strict sort of routines. I mean, they were there, even if they were administered fairly, even if the management of the workers won all this sort of thing, they clearly were fighting against a very organised sort of an operation, wasn't it? Nothing haphazard or
laissez-faire
about it.
Oh, no, it was a very, you know, well-organised place, there's no doubt about that. And I think the company realised in those early days that it was in their best interests to have these union people working in the way that they were, because in actual fact, very often the convener would go into an area and sort things out with even any you know, contact with higher management.
And therefore,
and also sorted out a lot of the members' personal problems, you know, so that there was that element which, in fact, probably worked in the interests of the company. It was like an extension of the Personnel Industrial Relations Department, you know, that the union conveners carried out.
Yeah, well, they obviously wouldn't have done it if it hadn't have paid them. I mean, the company wouldn't have done it if it hadn't.
No, I mean, the management at the time realised that there was some benefit in having that, and that kept the workforce happy because they were able to liaise very easily with their union people.
It's interesting. I did an interview with stevedoring company in Melbourne, and the guy was talking about, you know, well, what a great lot the waterside workers were, because he was doing, the union had been very good to him, letting all the socialist countries work, you see, and oh, he was going, oh, yes, Thomas and Bill that, and Harry just, and when I went away, I said, he seems a decent fellow, and my friend Tom Hill said, yeah, and when he's talking about the workers in his office, he refers to that shit on the waterfront, you know.
Oh, really?
So I just was wondering, what was sort of the attitude, was management, was a management policy that kept, say, the white hats and the workers apart? Or, I mean, the whole thing seemed to have been fairly stratified. You know.
That was particularly so in the early stages of the project. I know, for instance, that the managerial staff had a better type of housing, and the colour of the hat was another thing, of course. The white hats were the staff and the coloured hats were the union or the working people. And I think that was sort of something that came out. I think that was the American influence. You know, there were American interests in the company at the time, and some of the managers were from the US or Canada, and so that seemed to be their influence. But I think as we proceeded further along, the people realised that they had to live together in this little community, isolated, you know, practically from the rest of the world. And so they overcame it naturally themselves. And whereas in the beginning, managerial staff wives wouldn't socialise with wages wives, that gradually sort of eased, and people became more of a a unified community, and they made a big effort, I suppose, to put that part of it aside when they went home or when they went out socially, that you they managed to overcome it. Yeah.
Well, you know what, how big's Wigan?
Oh, then I think a peak population has never been more than 3,000 people there.
Mm.
Probably be about 2 to 2.5 at the moment.
Mm, I see. So, and Panawanika's even smaller?
Yeah, Panawanika population would be less than 1,000. I don't know. It's probably still since
that's
they
right.
got
so
rid of some
even,
of the workforce.
So that's a strike, and the lockout and sort of thing would have struck that community very badly, wouldn't it?
Oh, both communities. It destroyed the whole social fabric of the place, because people didn't want to play darts with anybody anymore, because they're on the other side, you know. They're scabs, they're working, doing what the company says to take our jobs off us. And so
I was listening to one tape that Stuart did, and with a guy was saying that the foremen were told, you know, to buy their beer and take it home and not to talk to the others in the pub, you know?
Well, it reached the stage where staff people, in particular the middle management, which are the foremen and supervisory type staff, couldn't, you know, some of them couldn't go in and have a drink after work because of the volatile situation and the emotive, you know, thing that was building up, the whole trauma of the thing, just turned people against each other. It was just so divisive, and at the same time a lot of people left, and that created trauma on families. I mean, when your best friends are all leaving town and...
And the families who left were having to leave under situations which they hadn't chosen.
That's right, and so they had to sort of just launch off, some of them without a promise of a job anywhere else, just opted out of it. It was just such a dreadful situation. And so then things like sporting groups were affected. Softball teams lost members, and in Panawanika I think that had a big impact, being such a small community. And I don't know what the situation is there now, but I think it'd still be awful.
Listen to this interview with one lady who wouldn't sign the form. That must have been. Were you working there when this all happened?
No.
Oh,
I left around 1980 when Peter Dowding was elected to Parliament. He asked me to come down and manage his office here in Karratha. So I was well and truly off the scene when, you know, what for... 6 years. Yeah, I've been a member for 4 years, so I was well and truly out of it.
And you live in a company house, Phil?
No, we're in what they call GIHA housing, which is government employees housing. That goes with my husband's job with the health department.
Oh, I see.
So
you're not sort of, you didn't have to move out of your house when you left the company.
I was never in company housing. Which
that gives you a certain amount of freedom, doesn't it?
Yes.
Living in a company house make people... more dependent on the company?
Oh, definitely, yes. Yeah, I mean, there's always that big brother, you know, leaning over your shoulder sort of thing, I suppose. And I've had some pretty tragic stories that have been brought to my doorstep as the member for the area. Things like the guy dies of a heart attack very suddenly, and then the wife's in the situation where she doesn't work for the company, or she might work for them and just do a cleaning job, which doesn't... entitle her to company accommodation, and so then they have to go through the whole trauma of getting the company to leave them there, you know, until they sort themselves out.
And do the companies leave them there, or do they?
Sometimes they do for a short period of time, but eventually they have to leave.
So there's not really, the rules are fairly inflexible on that sort of thing. I mean, company houses are for company employees.
And, of course, during the dispute, if someone was in conflict with management of the company, well, they were just ordered out of their house. In actual fact, we were advising them to stick where they were and not to be intimidated to leave, have to take their kids out of school that day and be out by night or something. And so the union backup in that respect was good. You know, they were able to advise people.
You go on, I interrupted you, what you were talking about.
What was I up to now?
I think you were talking about when you were working up in the... the last thing you said was you experienced discrimination.
Yes, yeah. And then I went to work in the maintenance superintendent's office and stayed there for about a year, I suppose it was, and then when Peter Dowding was elected, well, I left Robe River and came to the Karratha office to work here. And
what do you think's the future? I mean, these towns, I can't quite understand why Karratha's an open town and the others aren't. I mean, wasn't this built by Annesley Arran, Karratha?
No, Karratha, in fact, was established, I suppose partly as a result of the fact that Dampier just ran out of space to build any more houses, and so Hammersley Iron were looking at somewhere else to build, but the government of the day decided that there was a need for a town, you know, a centre for the area, and so they established it, and although we've got Hammersley housing and we've got Woodside housing, it is an open town, it's not a company.
Is Port Hedland similar to this? Has it got company housing too?
It has got some company housing, yeah, quite a bit of Mount Newman housing and a few Goldsworthy as well.
Has Port Hedland has grown as big as this, or is it bigger?
Port Hedland is slightly larger in population than Karratha.
Yeah. Well, tell me something about the, if you would mind, about the, sort of the problems of the town, because I gather there's you know, shortage of housing and unemployed people and shortage of, you know, sort of social
The town of Karratha is under extreme stress, you know, socially, as a result of the construction stage of the second phase of the North West Gas thing. We went through a very similar period when they did their first stage. What happens, I think, is when you've got a much publicised project of the size of, you know, that gas project that's taking place out there, people seem to flock from all around the countryside to see if they can get work on the you know, construction stage,
because it's well paid.
A lot of them come on spec. And so the town is sort of, you know, the accommodation situation is straining at the seams at the moment. The problem from the government's point of view is we can't, well, I mean, you couldn't suddenly find $1 billion to build everybody a house anyway, but we don't know really, nobody can accurately predict, of course, as to how the town will settle down when this construction stage is finished, probably in 1989. I mean, it would be rather irresponsible of the government, for instance, to build hundreds and hundreds of Homes West houses if they're not going to be needed in 2 years' time, because when the construction stage is over, apparently the permanent workforce out there will only be about 500 people.
And how many would be working there now?
Oh, there'd be 3,000 or 4,000 people during the construction.
And this is not as—is this bigger than the first stage?
Oh yes, yes.
And the construction companies don't have any responsibility to provide housing for their people, do they?
The Woodside company in their original agreement had to say what accommodation they were providing, and I just had a briefing with them yesterday actually, and I've got a paper in there which sets out exactly what they agreed to and how far down the track they are, and they are in fact meeting their commitments at the present time.
What does that mean they provide?
So they're providing permanent housing. I think they're looking at building 540 houses, and they're up to about 523. And then they're also assisting some of the subcontracting firms by including in their agreements and their contracts, provision in the payment for provision of, you know, accommodation. And so the way we're handling the sort of temporary workers is really with those ATCO units, which are like a transportable small house, and caravans. We've got 4 caravan parks which are full at the moment, or, you know, near enough to full. And Fleetwood, I understand, is looking at extending the Sea Ripple Road caravan park by another 200 bays. And they're also looking at bringing up 30 mobile homes, which are very large, probably similar to the transportable things.
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because I presume that a lot of the construction workers are married and have families. I mean, they will be single men or women, aren't they?
Well, the company also has a caravan park out at Hyacinth Cove, plus a lot of single accommodation. Mm-hmm. And I think where we've had a slight problem that couldn't have been foreseen is that some of the single people don't like single quarters. And so what they've done is they've grouped together because they're being pretty well paid during the construction stages. So two or three of them will get together and rent a house in town, and because that takes one more house off the rental market. And the rents are very high, but of course if you've two or three friends are all putting in together, it's not quite
two
so...
Two or three single blokes.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, they can money, afford a so bit I mean, more, can't they?
Yes, yes. So that's put a bit of extra pressure on the
yes,
on the
I believe someone
market.
Said they were charging up to $100 a room.
Oh, yes, yeah, see, the rents are sky high because, you know, there are people flocking in and we haven't got enough housing.
And
Homes West is... got a construction program of about 32 houses, which they're, you know, working on now, and they're just about to come down with next year's budget, so there'll probably be another 30 or 40. But altogether, in the last 3 years or so, the government's built 200 houses in Karratha, so you can't say that there's been any neglect. I mean, when you're looking at a building cost of, say, $100,000, that's with the land included. It doesn't go very far.
It's very,
you get
very
two
very
houses
expensive.
Down in Perth for that, just
yes,
about.
Right. And of course, as you say, it's not only you're the whim of the international market up here. I mean, one of those mines that closed down and put themselves in mothballs.
Mm.
International, three of them, they all got it. If the international price of oil fell, then you've got to go to town.
Yeah,
you?
So it's easy to see how difficult it is to attract private investment in housing in this town. Mm. Nobody's quite convinced, you know, as to what's going to happen in a few years' time. And because of the huge capital that you have to build housing here, the reason being, of course, that all the material is freighted up, that adds to the cost, plus the cyclone, you know.
I was surprised that they didn't, for instance, open up a cement brick factory here and build with cement, locally made cement bricks.
No, and you see, these projects have just come up so suddenly. There hasn't really been
a
period, or the town hasn't been established long enough for those sorts of investments to be made.
Yeah.
And,
yes, and also if the sort of, you know, the brick veneer mentality takes place. I'm seeing you can't build anything else but brick in the town, I see. Right somewhere. Oh, that thing you
Oh, right, there. Yes. Yeah, there are a few fibro houses which were built in the very early days of the town. I think they're mainly government houses.
Yes, and also they take quite a bit of maintenance because they get a bit of painting, more painting and that sort of thing.
Yes,
yeah.
And, that sort of and so all the company housing is... that nice clay sort of brick, very light coloured. Mm-hmm. I noticed a multicoloured one up there the other day when we were looking.
It is a bit suburban, isn't it? It's
really, yes.
I suppose no one sort of sat down and thought about building houses suitable for the climate.
They tend to be building houses that are suitable to be air-conditioned, but not... although the housing standard has improved, no, since when I first arrived here... they're not really looking at developing a style of house that
it's cheap
you can, yes, yeah, and you can do without air conditioning for, you know, part of the year at least.
Yeah. What do people do who can't get a job with the this housing problem must make it very difficult for people who are out of work or women who want to leave their husbands, perhaps, you know, back at work. I mean, it must be very difficult to get any alternative accommodation in this town.
Oh, it's impossible. It really is. If there's a house vacant, it's at a, you know, astronomical rental. So for those sorts of people, they wouldn't last very long unless they were able to get a Homes West place, which then they can have a rebated rent.
There's a fairly long waiting list, don't
you? Yes, I understand from Jeff Moulds over at Homes West office that he's got about 400 people waiting at the moment. I had the Minister for Housing here the other day and we were looking at the numbers and we're trying to sort of find out where all those 400 people are from. Are they just, you know, people coming in on spec trying to get work or are they local people? And Jeff seemed to think that it was, you know, a lot of people coming in looking for work. And he also said there was a high ratio of single parents on the list,
yes,
which we couldn't quite figure out why that would be, unless, you know, there might be young women, I suppose, with children following their